Welcome back to The Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Today we're talking about Anna Karenina, Part 1, Chapter 4. Oh dear, this doesn't look like it will end in reconciliation. And Maud has Dolly saying, "Don't I love him more than ever?" What are your thoughts on this line and some alternate translations, if we may? And what was your favourite line from this chapter? Content Pariah says, "I don't really have much to say about the plot, no theories or anything, but I just wanted to express how much I love reading along with you all." Thank you, Content Pariah. Gabrielle Thumbarella. Gabriella the Umbrella said, "Me too. I'm not an English native speaker, so I'm a bit shy to join the discussion, but I really love reading all opinions and theories, and it also gives me a daily push to read the next chapter." I think your English seems pretty damn good, and you can join in. Don't be shy. We're all at different levels here, so we'd love to hear your thoughts on the chapters. RJRJ said, "Don't be worried about English not being your native language. I'm English and feel somewhat stupid after reading everyone's deep and well-thought-out criticism of the book so far, even this early on. I have not scrutinized and edited anything I've written, especially on Reddit, like I have my input on this sub in years. Your English is fine. RJRJ. Hey, I'm the host of the podcast. I created this community as a little spin-off from A Year of War and Peace. And let me tell you something. I'm pretty dumb. I'm a dumb person. Like, this is, it's the whole point of this podcast is you get to experience Anna Karenina vicariously via someone who's not very smart. An idiot's guide to Anna Karenina. And yet, every now and then, someone will give me a bit of props for something I said, as if I've actually added something valuable to the conversation. So hey, just say a bunch of stuff and occasionally you'll get something right. That's my theory. Little Birdie 8612 said, "I think a reconciliation is possible, not because of anything Oblonsky may say to apologize, but because of Dolly's own steady loyalty and moral strength. She could not break herself of the habit of looking upon him as a husband. And she could not leave Oblonsky's household because her five children would be much worse off where she was taking them." Dolly's sense of duty to her role as a wife and mother is enduring, in spite of the cruel indifference of her husband. Her emotional suffering is so great, her screams are as if they were caused by physical pain. Yet she is able to put aside her own intense pain, her desire to punish and humiliate Oblonsky, for the sake of her children and Oblonsky himself. It's so sacrificial. Tolstoy uses juxtaposition to show the sincerity and depth of Dolly's emotions in stark contrast to Oblonsky's shallowness. Both unsuccessfully try to conceal their feelings. Dolly's emotional indifference, her outward emotional indifference, gives way to her inner pain. Oblonsky's outward pain gives way to his inner indifference. For Dolly, her emotions triumph. For Oblonsky, his superficiality. This incredible emotional strength of Dolly is what makes her strong. Sure, Oblonsky radiates freshness and good health, but lacks sincerity. On the other hand, Dolly is emaciated and her fingers are bony, but her emotions are real and true. This difference in physical appearance is also indicative of the fact that only Dolly has been suffering from Oblonsky's mistakes. And it's all well and good for Oblonsky as long as he doesn't have to confront the pain he's inflicted. He could calmly read his newspaper and drink his coffee in the morning, but the moment he saw Dolly cry, a lump rose in his throat and his eyes glistened with tears. He only feels emotions as they come. There's nothing deep or rooted about his feelings. His reaction is merely a result of his own discomfort with true emotions, such as Dolly's. I have to have a little break because literally every movement of my mouth that I make at the moment is making it like a cracking in my jaw, and it's really, really annoying. I can't talk because every word I say, I don't know if you can actually hear it, but I can hear it in my skull. It's like a cracking in my jaw. So I don't know what the heck is going on. I'm going to have a little break. It will be instantaneous for you, the listener, but I'll be right back. All right, I'm back. I got myself a green tea and I put Vicks Vapor Rub all around my nose and my chest. Oh, I can't hear it anymore. That was really annoying. Like every single little movement of my mouth and jaw was making like a cracking, clicking noise inside my jaw. It was driving me crazy. Unlike Oblonsky, little birdie, 8612 continues, Dolly is emotionally perceptive and she can see right through her husband's shallow love. She says his tears are water. While Dolly feels a turbulent mixture of hate and love towards him, he can only give her empty pity. And it's happening again, and it's really annoying. What is happening inside my skull right now? I'm sorry if you can hear that cracking. What is that noise? Not cracking, it's like a grinding noise. Like, it's like there's a grain of sand in my jaw or something, and it's grinding. Oh my god. Well, let's see how we go here. I'm obviously struggling tonight. This must be very entertaining for you all to listen to. Just an aside, says Little Birdie. It's interesting that upon entering the room, Oblonsky's first words aren't apologetic. The last three chapters have built up to this moment of high tension and emotion. We've been expecting Oblonsky's humanity and humility to come out so that he may reconcile with his wife. But all he says is, Anna is arriving today. The weight of three previous chapters is thus placed on this one piece of information. This is immediately just another show of Oblonsky's shallow nature, but on another level Tolstoy is giving Anna's arrival the significance of a long-sought repentance, forgiveness and reconciliation. What kind of person is Anna going to be? No doubt her arrival might set the book in motion. It's truly disgusting when after their meeting Oblonsky can only think of an old joke about a German watchmaker of how unladylike Dolly's accusations were. Tolstoy really criticizes Russia in the Victorian era for only thinking of on social principles. Meanwhile, Dolly's professed love to her husband when she returns to her room is both heartbreaking and admirable. Dolly's love is the sort that is only strengthened by difficulties, but I wonder, is this the same as Dolly forgiving Oblonsky? I don't think so, but it may lead to forgiveness eventually. In the end, if a reconciliation comes, it will not be on Oblonsky's part. It will be on the magnanimity of Dolly and her emotional depth and sincerity. Well, Little Birdie, I've just got to say, your comments so far in this project have been amazing. So well thought out. They're like little essays. If I had to do an essay about this chapter, I could not do a better job of it than what you've done there. Some people just have the gift of the gab, don't they? I really appreciate the comments. Mango Mondo said, God, wonderful insight into the emotions expressed by Oblonsky and Dolly. I totally upended my reading of their interaction. I was a bit suckered by Oblonsky's emotional outpouring, but I think you're right. It's all superficial compared to Dolly's suffering. Secretly, part of me hopes that Oblonsky isn't as awful as he seems. It isn't fun to have a character so blasé, but I think he isn't really evil, just weak and oblivious. Thermos of Beer said, for question number three, it was Dolly, he said, sobbing now. For God's sake, think of the children. What was question three? Oh, your favourite line. Dolly, he said, sobbing now. For God's sake, think of the children. That put a big smile on my face. Even back then, no one thought of the children. Why doesn't anybody ever think of the children? Euler is a pimp, said. I took it as her saying that now that she's faced with losing her husband and living a life without him, that it has painted bluntly for her how much she loves him and how painful such a separation would be. A kind of absence makes my heart grow fonder, except with the absence as a threat instead of a reality. I Am Norwegian said, I get the impression that Dolly is frustrated with herself for being unable to truly hate her husband. Even after what he did, she still loves him. A nuance lost in English but found in the annotation of the Bartlett translation is that throughout the conversation, Dolly's word choice becomes less formal. She switches from polite vi over the familiar tea. She is warming up to Stepan, at least for a moment. When she calls him loathsome, she switches back. Stepan's sobbing surprised me. Maybe he isn't as cavalier as I had assumed. Yet after the altercation, he seems more concerned with if the maids heard them or not than anything else. He calls her, shouting, tawdry, cheap and ugly, a very dismissive word choice. Maud has Dolly saying, don't I love him more than ever? Bartlett says, don't I love him even more than before? I have no idea how to interpret the sentiment, though. If she feels that she should hate him, maybe the love that used to be natural now feels unnatural and therefore stronger. I agree with you, Ander, that I never got the impression of a hugely patriarchal society reading these 19th century Russian books. Pretty much every woman in the Brothers Karamazov were very independent. Grushenka especially was working and saving her own money and seemingly doing whatever she wanted. In The Gambler, it is the grandmother who is clearly the matriarch, and her showing up switches the power dynamic right in her favour. Sluggy said, I also thought the note about the familiar and formal address was interesting, as well as where it happens. Only when speaking about the children does Dolly soften and use the familiar form of address before going back. This notion is repeated again shortly after when one of the children cries out and Steva thinks, she does love my child, though, he thought, noticing how her face had changed when the child cried out, my child, so how can she hate me? My child, so how can she hate me? Yeah, that's definitely something that's lost in the translation, isn't it? That switch between formal and informal language. We don't really have the equivalent in English. I suppose we probably do, but I just didn't notice it. Excuse me. Techrific said, the first mention of Anna Karenina. Typical of Russians to delay the entrance of the main character. Dolly hates Steva's kind-heartedness. A character trait I suspect was once beloved by her, as it seems to still be among the staff of the household. Isn't it funny how we love certain aspects in our partner, and somehow those same aspects we later come to loathe? Yule is a pimp said, actually Anna was first mentioned in chapter 2, but your point still stands. Mayef said, is it just me, or does it seem like Daya is way too involved in the tiny details of the household? The last paragraphs have her worrying about the children not having their dinner until 6 and asking the servant if she has sent for milk. In a well-run household with lots of servants, shouldn't all this be on autopilot? I am wondering if this is indicative of Daya's personality. My first thought is that she may be extremely controlling and unwilling to give any of her servants the ability to make even the smallest decisions. It will be interesting to see if this proves to be true. Simply Productive said, I just wanted to add about the female issue that continues to pop up. I think it's important to note that along with cheating, it has become a polarized issue in order to change public opinion on it. What I mean is that cheating in the past used to be swept under the rug and very infrequently ended in divorce because of the illegality of divorce and because of this social stigma. We had to demonize cheating to change how accepted it was, as cheating used to be the only option in a loveless marriage. Similarly, with the differences between men and women in legal terms, we have had to demonize the lack of political rights women had in order to change the perspective on that as well. But women weren't treated as objects in person just by law, and it wasn't viewed as an inferiority, but rather just an interpretation of a division of the responsibilities in the household. In the same way, we can predict that shortly the constant commercials where men are depicted as slobby, unable to care for children, and generally just more stupid than women, those commercials will be demonized in short order as well. It's important to note that cheating is wrong, that women do deserve the right to vote and own property, and men are not actually incapable of cleaning. But the fact that these issues has become so polarized isn't like an on-off switch. Before women had the vote, they weren't chained to a wall and used as baby-making machines, at least not normally. In the same way that today, we realize the commercials making fun of men are mostly absurd. It was a grey area in the time. When people comment about the patriarchy and about how women had no say over their own familial land or things like that, There is a degree in which the point is simultaneously true and false. Life was never that black and white. It isn't today, and it wasn't then. It's a valid point to bring up, but not quite so aggressively, perhaps. And there you go. I don't really think it's grounds for a debate about, I don't know. What am I saying here? What I want to say is let's just read and see kind of thing. Because all I was trying to say is it seems like we jumped the gun on sort of talking about how patriarchal the society was because of just these first few chapters did kind of paint a little bit of that picture. But I think we might have taken a few little leaps there, and I'm only basing that on the other two Russian classics that I've read from this era. So I think we just keep reading and see, right? I think that's what we do. Hello, says Format Kaka. Started reading the book today. Here is what I believe is happening. He has definitely committed many mistakes in the past, and they always ended in reconciliation. That proves why he has been taking Daya for granted. But the behavior Daya shows this time is kind of confusing to him. On one hand, it seems like she is ready to leave him, but the last line of the chapter and her saying, "Don't I love him more than ever," indicates that she is afraid of taking the path less taken. To me, it seems like they are going to reconcile, given the second point, last line of the chapter, and Anna coming into the picture. Also, the land forest deal, it seems Stepan will go to any limits to make amends. The complete narration is beautiful, but I liked the following two lines the most. "Go away, get out of the room," she shrieked, still more shrilly, "and don't talk to me of your passion and your loathsomeness." And Stepan Arkadyevich sighed, wiped his face, and with a subdued tread, walked out of the room. Matvey says she will come around, but how? I don't see the least chance of it. Ah, oh, how terrible it is, and how vulgarly she shouted, he said to himself, remembering her shriek and the words scoundrel and mistress. And very likely the maids were listening. Horribly vulgar, horrible. Stepan Arkadyevich stood a few seconds alone, wiped his face, squared his chest, and walked out of the room. That is the Garnet. I was going to say that sounds like Garnet translation to me. That is very Garnet. Because reading that, I was like, I don't remember this being in the chapter. And Garnet has a way of, it's just me, it's just a personal thing, but whatever Garnet writes goes in one ear and out the other, so to speak. And very much. And also Garnet seems to be obsessed with the word scoundrel. Lomik91 said, Oblonsky could think of his wife, could hope that things would shape themselves, as Matthew had said, and could calmly read his paper and drink his coffee. But when he saw her worn, suffering face and heard her tone, resigned and despairing, he felt a choking sensation. A lump rose to his throat and tears glistened in his eyes. This is my favourite line. I didn't understand if he is really feeling guilty or because it's how Dolly wants him to be, so he's acting this way. Again, his personality, or lack of it, emerges. Syntax Approval said, this is obviously a very hairy matter. This act by Stepan is still quite fresh, and there are a lot of variables to consider, given the longevity of their marriage, with children, the land sale, and quite possibly the introduction of the sister. I'd guess that a situation will get patched up, with some long-standing consequences, which may have already been foreshadowed. It seems as if Stepan has for too long relied on his charm to get himself out of situations. In this case, his charm appears to be detrimental. Hopefully, he'll grow to become a better person because of it. I'm not holding my breath, though. If even your own children can sense your bullshit, it's time to change your ways. Maybe his sister will verbally call him out on this said bullshit. Okay, JMama8779 had this to say. I think this will end up okay between the two of them. We're just witnessing the chaos of the immediate aftermath. Both characters are creatures of habit, and they will reconcile if only to resume their normal life. Obviously, she loves her husband, and she realizes this more when she wishes to be angry and leave. She wants to resume her normal life, but she also loves her husband too much to leave him. Al Treat said, I'm not so sure it doesn't... Oh, sorry. In response to, this doesn't look like it will end in reconciliation. I'm not so sure, although I do think something is newly ruptured between them and perhaps can't be fully healed. I think there are lots of clues in here that she will forgive him, most of all being that she really seems to want to. She loves him. When he was apologizing, she was willing to give him a chance, but then hurt again at the mention of the infatuation. She knows that it would probably reflect poorly on her and her children, which is likely why she hasn't left yet. The second discussion point, her saying, in my translation, don't love him more than before, don't I love him more than before, points to her wanting a reconciliation. I think she wants it more than anything, but is very deeply hurt and not ready to be pacified yet. My version has her saying, don't I love him more than before, the most terrible thing is... dot, dot, dot. What is the most terrible thing? I'm dying to know. Dr. Nature 96 said, I quite like Daya Alexandrovna. She doesn't sound like a mean person, even though we've been told she has a temper. She sounds very responsible in her household activities and childcare. Are we allowed random comments like this, or do we have to stick strictly to the following discussion prompts? Edit. Also, I remember suggestions that the staff side with Oblonsky because of his status, but rather, at this point, it seems quite clear that they side with him because of his outstandingly easy nature, but I felt hurt for Daya when she noticed him looking healthy and unaffected. My own description. Well, she was completely ruined. Swim said the moment Fishy answered this, saying, random comments are great, I do it all the time, and absolutely. Just to address that one question, are we allowed random comments like this, or do we have to strictly follow the discussion prompts? No, random comments are encouraged, and also follow-up prompts, follow-up questions. The discussion prompts are just a jumping-off point to get the discussion going, but really, if there's any thoughts that you have about the chapter, put them in the discussion. If you've got questions, if there's a line that, you know, you want some more information or more clarity around, or if you notice something and you want to point it out, anything to help pick apart the chapter. Sometimes, because I write the discussion prompts, I just literally use it as a way to clarify plot points that I'm not 100% on. Like yesterday with the forest thing, I read it and I 90% it sunk in that he wanted to sell the forest, but they had to reconcile first. But I was like, oh, I just want to make sure I'm 100% clear about that plot point in case it's important. So I just put it as a discussion prompt, hoping to gain clarity. And I did. And by the end of the discussion, I had my head, you know, wrapped around that little plot point. Easy. But yeah, do the same thing. Drop questions in the discussion. I think it's really cool as a resource. I did this a lot with War and Peace as well, where just any little thing that confused me or I just wanted to make sure I had it right, I would just ask in the daily discussion. And it's just great that people who know a lot more about it than I would go in and answer. So yeah, that's a long answer to a short question. Please discuss whatever you want in the discussion forum. You can also post other things in the subreddit if you like. It's your subreddit too, so you know, whatever you want, some memes, some funny links or resources or anything. So just please use the subreddit however you want. It's yours to play with. All right, that is the conversation of the podcast done. Now let's read the next chapter. It's a bit of a long one again. Oh yeah, and also just a little update. Someone, I can't remember who it was, somebody asked me if the podcast is on Spotify, and it now is. It should now be there. So if you are a Spotify user, that's where you do your podcasting. You can now subscribe to the podcast that way. All right. Here is part one, chapter 5. Oblonsky's natural ability had helped him to do well at school, but mischief and laziness had caused him to finish very low in his year's class. Yet, in spite of his dissipated life, his unimportant service rank, and his comparative youth, he occupied a distinguished and well-paid post as head of one of the government boards in Moscow. This post he had obtained through Alexis Alexandrovich Karenin, his sister Anna's husband, who held one of the most important positions in the ministry to which the Moscow board belonged. But even if Karenin had not nominated his brother-in-law for that post, Stiva Oblonsky, through one of the 100 other persons, brothers, sisters, relations, cousins, uncles or aunts, would have obtained this or a similar post with a salary of some 6,000 rubles a year, which he needed because, in spite of his wife's substantial means, his affairs were in a bad way. Half Moscow and half Petersburg were his relations or friends. He was born among those who were or who became the great ones of this world. One third of the official world, the older men, were his father's friends and had known him in petticoats. He was on intimate terms with another third and was well acquainted with the last third. Consequently, the distributors of earthly blessings, such as government posts, grants, concessions, and the like, were all his friends. They could not overlook one who belonged to them, so that Oblonsky had no special difficulty in obtaining a lucrative post. He had only not to raise any objections, not to be envious, not to quarrel, and not to take offence, all things which, being naturally good-tempered, he never did. It would have seemed to him ridiculous had he been told that he would not get a post with the salary he required, especially as he did not demand anything extraordinary. He only wanted what other men of his age and set were getting, and he could fill such an office as well as anybody else. Oblonsky was not only liked by everyone who knew him for his kind and joyous nature and his undoubted honesty, but there was something in him, in his handsome and bright appearance, his beaming eyes, black hair and eyebrows, and his white and rosy complexion, that had a physical effect on those he met, making them feel friendly and cheerful. "Ah, Stiva Oblonsky, here he is," said almost everyone he met, smilingly. Even if conversation with him sometimes caused no special delight, still the next day or the next everyone was as pleased as ever to meet him. It was the third year that Oblonsky had been head of that government board in Moscow, and he had won not only the affection but also the respect of his fellow officials, subordinates, chiefs, and all who had anything to do with him. The chief qualities that had won him this general respect in his office were first his extreme leniency, founded on a consciousness of his own defects. Secondly, his true liberalism, not that of which he read in his paper, but that which was in his blood and made him treat all men alike, whatever their rank or official position. Thirdly and chiefly, his complete indifference to the business he was engaged in consequence of which he was never carried away by enthusiasm and never made mistakes. Having arrived at his destination, Oblonsky, respectfully followed by the doorkeeper bearing his portfolio, entered his little private room, put on his uniform, and came out into the office. The clerks and attendants all rose and bowed cheerfully and respectfully. Oblonsky walked quickly, as was his wont, to his place, shook hands with the members, and sat down. He chatted and joked just as much as was proper, and then turned to business. No one could determine better than he the limits of freedom, simplicity, and formality necessary for the pleasant transaction of business. The secretary came up with the papers, cheerfully and respectfully, like everybody in Oblonsky's office, and remarked in the familiarly liberal tone introduced by Oblonsky, "After all, we've managed to get that information from the Penza provincial office. Here, will you please..." "Got it at last," said Oblonsky, holding this paper down with his finger. "Well, gentlemen," and the sitting commenced. "If they only knew," he thought, bowing his head gravely as he listened to a report How like a guilty little boy their president was half an hour ago. And his eyes sparkled while the report was being read. Till 2 o'clock, the business was to continue uninterruptedly, but at 2 there was to be an adjournment for lunch. It was not quite 2 when the large glass door suddenly swung open and someone came in. All the members from beneath the Emperor's portrait and from behind the mirror of justice, glad of some distraction, looked towards the door, but the doorkeeper at once turned out the intruder and closed the glass doors behind him. When the report had been read, Oblonsky rose, stretching himself and paying tribute to the liberalism of the times, took out a cigarette before leaving the office to go to his private room. Two of his colleagues, Nikitin, an old hard-working official, and Grinevich, a gentleman of the bedchamber, followed him out. "We shall have time to finish after lunch," said Oblonsky. "Plenty of time," said Nikitin. "He must be a precious rogue, that Fomin," said Grinevich, referring to one of those concerned in the case under consideration. Oblonsky made a face at these words, thereby indicating that it is not right to form an opinion prematurely, and did not reply. "Who was it came in?" he asked the doorkeeper. "Some man came in without permission, Your Excellency. When I wasn't looking, he asked for you. I told him when the members came out. Then, where is he? Perhaps he has gone out into the hall. He was walking about there just now. That's him," said the doorkeeper, pointing to a strongly built, broad-shouldered man with a curly beard, who, without taking off his sheepskin cap, was running lightly and quickly up the worn steps of the stone staircase. A lanky official going down with a portfolio stopped with a disapproving look at the feet of the man running upstairs, and then glanced inquiringly at Oblonsky, who was standing at the top of the stairs. His kindly face, beaming over the gold-embroidered collar of his uniform, grew still more radiant when he recognized the man who was coming up. "Yes, it's he, Levin, at last," he said, scrutinizing the approaching Levin with a friendly, mocking smile. "How is it you deign to look me up in this den?" he asked, and not contented with pressing his friend's hand, he kissed him. "Been here long?" "I've only just arrived, and I am very anxious to see you," answered Levin, looking round with constraint, and yet crossly and uneasily. "Well then, come into my room," said Oblonsky, who knew his friend's self-conscious and irritable shyness, and seizing him by the arm, he led him along as if past some danger. Oblonsky was on intimate terms with almost all his acquaintances, men of 60 and lads of 20, actors, ministers of state, tradesmen, and lords in waiting, so that a great many people on familiar terms with him stood at the two extremes of the social ladder, and would have been much surprised to know that they had something in common through Oblonsky. He was on familiar terms with everybody he drank champagne with, and he drank champagne with everybody. But when in the presence of his subordinates he happened to meet any of his disreputable pals, as he jokingly called them, he was able, with his innate tact, to minimize the impression such a meeting might leave on their minds. Levin was not a disreputable pal, but Oblonsky felt that Levin imagined he might not care to show their intimacy in the presence of the subordinates, and that was why he hurried into his private room. Levin and Oblonsky were almost of the same age, and with Levin, Oblonsky was on familiar terms, not through champagne only. Levin had been his comrade and friend in early youth, and they were fond of one another as friends who have come together in early youth often are, in spite of the difference in their characters and tastes. Yet, as often happens between men who have chosen different pursuits, each while in argument justifying the other's activity, despised it in the depths of his heart. Each thought that his own way of living was real life, and that the life of his friend was illusion. Oblonsky could not repress a slightly sarcastic smile at the sight of Levin. How many times he had already seen him arriving in Moscow from the country, where he did something, though what it was Oblonsky could never quite understand or feel any interest in. Levin came to Moscow, always excited, always in a hurry, rather shy and irritated by his own shyness, and usually with totally new and unexpected views about things. Oblonsky laughed at all this, and yet liked it. Similarly, Levin in his heart despised the town life with his friend was leading, and his official duties, which he considered futile and ridiculed. But the difference was that Oblonsky, doing as everyone else did, laughed with confidence and good humour, while Levin laughed uncertainly and sometimes angrily. "We have long been expecting you," said Oblonsky, entering his private room and releasing Levin's arm, as if to show that here all danger was past. "I'm very, very glad to see you," continued he. "Well, how are you, eh? When did you arrive?" Levin looked silently at the faces of the two strangers, Oblonsky's colleagues, and especially at the hands of the elegant Grinevich, who had such long white fingers and such long yellowish nails curving at the point, and such large glittering sleeve links, that evidently his hands occupied his whole attention and deprived him of freedom of thought. Oblonsky at once noticed Levin's look and smiled. "Oh, of course, let me introduce you," he said. "My colleague, Philip Ivanich Nikitin, Michael Stanislavich Grinevich," then turned to Levin. "Konstantin Dmitrich Levin, an active member of the Zemstvo, a gymnast who lifts 100 weight and a half with one hand, a cattle breeder, a sportsman, my friend and a brother of Sergius Ivanich Koznishev." "Very pleased," said the old official. "I have the honour of knowing your brother, Sergius Ivanovich," said Grinevich, holding out his narrow hand with long fingernails. Levin frowned, shook hands coldly, and immediately turned to Oblonsky. Though Levin had great respect for his stepbrother, an author known throughout Russia, he hated to be regarded not as Konstantin Level, but as a brother of the famous Koznishev. "No, I am no longer on the Zemstvo. I have quarrelled with the lot of them, and don't attend their meetings any more, thank God, because I don't know how to say that word," said he, addressing his friends. "Quick work," said Oblonsky with a smile. "What was it all about?" "It's a long story. I'll tell you some other time," said Levin, but at once began telling it. "To put it in a nutshell, I have come to the conclusion that there is and can be no such thing as Zemstvo work," he said, speaking as if someone had just offended him. "On the one hand, it's simply playing. They play it being a parliament, and I am neither young enough nor old enough to amuse myself with toys. On the other hand," he hesitated, "it is a means of getting pelf for the provincial coterie. We used to have guardianships and judgeships as soft jobs, and now we've zemstvos, not bribes, but unearned salaries," he went on as warmly as if he had just been contradicted. "Aha, I see you've reached another phase, a conservative one this time," said Oblonsky. "However, we'll talk about that later." "Yes, later. But I want to see you," said Levin, gazing with an aversion at Grinevich's hand. Oblonsky's smile was hardly perceptible. "Didn't you tell me you would never again put on Western European clothes?" he asked, surveying Levin's new suit, evidently made by a French tailor. "That's it. You're in a new phase." Levin suddenly blushed. Not as grown-up people blush, who hardly notice it themselves, but as boys blush, who are aware that their shyness is ridiculous, and therefore feel ashamed of it and blush still more, almost to tears. It was so strange to see that intelligent, manly face in such a childish condition that Oblonsky left off looking at him. "Where shall we see one another? You know it is very, very important for me to have a talk with you," said Levin. Oblonsky seemed to consider. "Well, suppose we go to lunch at Gurin's and have a talk there. I am free till 3. "No," said Levin, after a moment's consideration. "I have to go somewhere else." "Well, then, let's dine together." "Dine? But I've nothing particular to say, only a word or two." "To ask you something. We can have a talk some other time." "Well, tell me the word or two now, and we'll talk at dinner." "The two words are, however, it's nothing particular," said Levin, and his face became almost vicious in its efforts to overcome his shyness. "What are the Shabatskys doing? All going on as usual?" Oblonsky, who had long known that Levin was in love with Oblonsky's sister-in-law Kitty, smiled very slightly and his eyes sparkled merrily. You spoke of two words, but I can't answer in two because, excuse me a moment. The secretary came in, familiarly respectful, though with a certain modest consciousness common to all secretaries, of his superiority to his chief in knowledge of business affairs, approached Oblonsky with some papers, and, on the plea of asking a question, began to explain some difficulty. Oblonsky, without hearing him to the end, put his hand in a kindly way on the secretary's sleeve, and softening his remark with a smile, said, "No, please do it as I said," and having a few words explained his view of the matter. He pushed the paper away and said finally, "Yes, please do it that way, Zachary Nikitich. The secretary went out, abashed. Levin, who during Oblonsky's talk with the secretary had quite overcome his shyness, stood leaning both arms on the back of a chair and listening with ironical attention. "I don't understand it at all," he remarked. "What don't you understand?" said Oblonsky, with his usual merry smile. As he took out a cigarette, he expected Levin to say something eccentric. "I don't understand what you're doing," said Levin, shrugging his shoulders. "How can you do it seriously?" "Why not?" "Because there's nothing to do." "That's how it seems to you, but really we're overwhelmed with work." "On paper." "Ah, well, you've a gift for that sort of thing," added Levin. "You mean I'm deficient in something?" "Perhaps," said Levin. "But all the same, I admire your dignity, and am proud that my friend is such a great man. But all the same, you've not answered my question," he added, making a desperate effort to look Oblonsky straight in the face. All right, wait a bit, and you'll be in the same position yourself. It's all very well for you, who have 3,000 desiatins in a Khorasan district, and such muscles, and are fresh as a 12-year-old girl. But still, you'll be joining us yourself some day. Now, about what you were asking, nothing has changed, but it's a pity you've stopped away so long." "Why?" asked Levin in alarm. "Oh, nothing," answered Oblonsky. "We'll talk it over later on. But what has brought you here especially?" "We'll talk about that later too." "Later on," said Levin, and again blushed to his very ears. "All right, that's natural enough," said Oblonsky. "Well, you know, I'd ask you to come to us, but my wife is not very well. Let's see, if you want to meet them, you'll be sure to find them in the zoological gardens from 4 to 5. Kitty skates there. Go there and I'll call for you and we'll dine somewhere together." "Splendid. Well then, au revoir." "Mind you, don't forget. I know you. You may rush off back to the country," shouted Oblonsky after him. "That'll be all right," said Levin and left the room, only recollecting when already at the door that he had not taken leave of Oblonsky's colleagues. "He seems a very energetic man," said Grinevich when Levin was gone. "Yes, my dear fellow," said Oblonsky, shaking his head. "And he's a lucky man. 3,000 desiatins in the Khorasan district, his life before him, and such freshness, not like some of us. What have you to complain of, Stefan Arkadyevich?" "Oh, things are wretched, miserable," said Oblonsky, and sighed heavily. All right, there we go, another chapter down. I do apologize for that reading. My jaw is still making a weird clicky thing. It's really bothering me. I'm also quite tired, so I was getting a bit confused trying to read those sentences. So not the best reading I've ever done. But hey, you seem to have made it to the end, so very well done. You can, if you like, support the podcast on patreon.com/thehemingwaylist. Head over to the subreddit if you want to have a bit of a chat about this chapter. Thank you for listening to today's episode. I'll see you tomorrow.